Hello, everyone. The United Nations' top rights body has agreed to launch an investigation into crimes committed during the recent Israeli onslaught on Gaza. Palestinians have welcomed the decision by the UN Human Rights Council. Before the adoption of the resolution on Thursday, UN Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet said that the deadly Israeli strikes on the Gaza Strip caused widespread destruction of civilian infrastructure and fatalities, and they might constitute war crimes. Israel rejected the UN rights body's decision, saying that it would not cooperate with the probe. Throughout the 11-day encounter, Israeli airstrikes killed at least 254 Palestinians, including 66 children, wounded almost 2,000, and displaced over 72,000 people. On the other side, Palestinian retaliatory attacks killed 12 people in the occupied territories. Our correspondent Asher Shannon is joining us now from Gaza to bring us up to speed on the humanitarian situation in the aftermath of the Israeli onslaught on the besieged Gaza Strip. Ashraf?
Well, but yeah, the humanitarian situation in the besieged enclave is the worst ever under the Israeli occupation and the Israeli blockade. As Israel continues to exert pressure on international agencies in order for them not to bring in aid and supplies into the enclave, they're trying to block the entry of humanitarian aid, and also that such aid includes hospital supplies, surgical supplies, and all sorts of needed equipment to help look for survivors, possible survivors under the rubble. Still, rescue crews are working round the clock since day one of the Israeli onslaught to try and find if there are more victims or more martyrs or wounded, and the possibility of finding people alive under the rubble is very slim.
All right, thanks a lot. That was our correspondent, Asher Shannon, joining us from the Gaza Strip. Joining us on this debate, we have journalist and political analyst Julia Kassem joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Also, historian and journalist Breck Jonkers is joining us from Hasselt, Belgium. Welcome to the program, to the both of you. Let's start off with Ms. Kassem in Beirut. The top UN human rights body has voted to create an open-ended international investigation into Israel's treatment of Palestinians. As we mentioned earlier, the Palestinian Authority said the decision amounts to international recognition of Israel's systemic oppression and discrimination against the Palestinian people. How do you view this decision?
So we saw more consensus being reached this year on an ICC measure to investigate Israel for past war crimes. Just as kind of we're seeing right now, the UN taking steps to take an investigation into the mass murder by the occupation of Gazans. But at the same time, we have to, of course, be realistic on if this is going to translate into any real accountability or action against the occupation and against the onslaught it has caused onto Gazans. We remember in 2014, the UN also did an investigation and also did a report. But what the report turned out is that it rehashed the both sides narrative. It rehashed putting Hamas at fault as well. And this is absolutely not true. Hamas is just and all resistance forces that have worked out of Gaza and that have resisted the attacks from the occupation were just in self-defense, striking military targets, production facilities. And so both we just know of the UN that, first of all, it's obviously in the hands of the Western powers, and works essentially to their advantage and inclines towards capital, not human rights. So we're not going to really see any action. And even the condemnations that will come out are not going to reflect the disproportionate force and injustice that is represented every single time this illegal occupation slaughters Gazans.
Breck Jonkers, let's pick up on what our guest in Beirut just mentioned. There have been UN-led investigations in the past, most notably on Gaza. Will this one be any different?
Well, I guess for a major part, we just have to wait and see. But I think indeed it is a very good point to make that we should always temper our expectations when it comes to the United Nations doing anything. And because this so-called international community, as translated in the UN, has very often proven in the past to be relatively toothless and incapable or unwilling to make any lasting decisions or any major changes to the status quo as it exists now. That being said, I think it is important, of course, to point out the developments that are going in a positive direction and that somewhat give us that can give us hope to continue the struggle for the future. Because I think it goes without saying that it's due to the international, due to the national resistance of the Palestinians and the international work of the worldwide Palestine solidarity movement in general that has pressured so many countries in the world to eventually now support or at least abstain from the vote that was made in the UN Human Rights Council. Because when we see, of course, major nations such as China and Russia backing this proposal, which is one of the most, let's say, clear voiced condemnations of Israel that we have seen in the history of the United Nations, or at least for the past decades. And we see a lot of Western countries that are members of this Human Rights Council that you would normally expect to vote against it, such as France and Poland, for example, that who now have abstained for what I believe for a major part due to the fact that they know that there is a major international pressure, including people in their own countries, especially in countries such as France, of course, from the Muslim population and from the general population who opposes imperialism and supports human rights, that blocking a motion such as was made here by the Organization of Islamic Unity and by Pakistan, suggested by Pakistan here, that blocking this motion would be a completely, you know, unacceptable deed to do. Secondly, one other historical change is that this commission of inquiry, which was created now by the Human Rights Council, is the first ever commission of inquiry that has an ongoing permanent task. This means that they are set to investigate specifically starting these 11 days of conflict that have existed the past month. But they are looking for what happened these 11 days, but also what led up to it in general. And they are tasked with continuously monitoring the further human rights violations that could be committed by, could have been committed and will be committed potentially by the Zionist entity. So this is for the first time that the Commission of Inquiry has an ongoing, permanent, continuous task. There is no, let's say, date of ending this commission. There is no real, let's say, expiry date for this. And the third one is that the commission is specifically founded, according to the text that was passed by the council, this commission is founded to investigate all human rights violations committed in the Palestinian territories and in Israel itself, in what the Zionist entity itself. So this means that this will not just be, if it goes according to plan, let's say, the work of this commission will not just be limited to Gaza and to the West Bank and to East Jerusalem, but can also be used in general for human rights violations that happen within the borders of the Zionist entity as it has existed since 1967, or even since 1948, basically. So there is no part of Zionist occupation that will be absolved from commission inquiry. Of course, we still have to wait and see how effective and how efficient this commission will really be. But these three steps is something that would never have happened at all were it not for the pressure of the Palestinians and for the international Palestine solidarity movement. And so I think that by itself is already a victory.
Ms. Qasem, UN Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet said the Ademi airstrikes in such densely populated areas of Gaza resulted in a high level of civilian fatalities and injuries and may constitute war crimes if they are deemed to be indiscriminate and disproportionate in their impact on civilians. Well, in my opinion, the answers are already there when schools and media offices and medical facilities are targeted, when defenseless women and children are murdered. What more needs to be seen?
Exactly. The evidence is already there. In every single investigation or in every single attack on Gaza, it's been the same. Civilian infrastructure has been targeted. All kinds of infrastructure, including media infrastructure, schools, hospitals, they've all been the targets of Israeli war crimes, and everyone could see that despite the Zionist entities' attempted obfuscation of that through the targeting of the media offices, which spoke in itself. It was just apparent, and the evidence is just out there, and everybody recognizes that not only was the impact disproportionate, but it was completely criminal and obvious that there was a deliberate attack on civilians once again. Thankfully, the forward move from this resolution does show that there's going to be more of a condemnation and more of an investigation that's going to emphasize that too. It looks like just as the Palestinian resistance has put the Zionist entity on the defensive militarily, this investigation also will put the Zionist occupation on the defensive in the context of its human rights violations too. The United States and Israel have for too long enjoyed the having almost impunity in the eyes of the UN, whereas clearly they were violating multiple human rights violations and resolutions, I believe 65. With the change in attitude globally that is reflected in this resolution and in the global attitude towards the Zionist entity, we are going to see some pressure moving forth. It's also worth mentioning that from the West and the Zionist entity's defensiveness in wanting to abstain from voting on this or even voting no, the Zionist entity is also losing their impunity in their narrative, even in the realm of international human rights organizations like the UN. It's definitely looking positive that there is going to be accountability, not necessarily from the UN itself, but because of the successes coming from the Palestinian resistance and also from its the allies to this motion, which include station countries like China and Russia, which seem to also have more leverage in their condemnations and in their vote than previously.
Brecht Yonkers, Michelle Bachelet cautioned that violence could erupt again unless the quote-unquote root causes are addressed. I think the plural form of that word is a bit redundant here. What is the root cause other than the illegal occupation of Palestinian land by the Israeli regime?
I think you hit the nail on the head there. That is indeed basically the main cause to start it all. And that is, again, an interesting matter, because when you see the responses, the livid responses by the Israeli delegates in the United Nations, by the Zionist Prime Minister Netanyahu, and of course the even more radical people in the Zionist politics, such as Avigdor Lieberman, you see that their absolute meltdowns of responses often include an attempt to turn around the causality, which they have of course been doing for decades already, basically as long as Palestinian resistance has been around. They have always said, we are just defending ourselves from these rocket attacks, from these terrorist attacks, as they call it, from these what they believe to be Arabs who are anti-Semitic somehow, who don't want Jews in the land, etc. But people are starting to wake up more and more, and even now in the United Nations, you see that people are kind of, they're maybe not condemning, especially Western politicians and Western public opinion is not outright maybe condemning Israel for its core existence as a colonial settler entity. But at least they are rejecting, or at least quietly disregarding, the idea that Israel is merely defending itself, that Israel is merely responding. Because people start to wake up, of course, to the fact that this is all this all basically started with a colonialist project that began basically as far back as the Balfour Declaration of 1917 and really kicked off in 1948 after the British basically handed over the land as a silver platter to Zionist settlers. And ever since then, of course, there has been a constant cycle of violence that is not, maybe not really a cycle, but it's more like, you know, Zionist colonization and legitimate native indigenous response by the Palestinians to this colonization. So when it's a step forward when Michel Bachelet, a UN a functionary, says we have to look at the root causes. Of course, they still say causes. They keep it, let's say, politically correct. But the fact that they want to look at not just what happened in 2021, not just what happened now in the attack, but they want to look at how did it come there. And when you want to look at how did it come there, you have to look at Sheikh Jarrah, you have to look at East Jerusalem, you have to look at what happened with Al-Aqsa. And of course, you have to look at why is Gaza a besieged territory in the first place. And then you look at the elections of 2006 in which the Palestinians were denied the right basically to express their vote freely, or they expressed their votes, but since then were punished for it because apparently they were not allowed to have a democracy. This way you can start step by step, hopefully, go back in time until you really see, reach and undeniably show to the world, I hope, that the root cause is, as you said, Zionist colonization.
Julia Qassem, let's cross over now to events unfolding in the West Bank. Amnesty International recently said Israel must immediately halt the eviction of Palestinians from their homes in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. Anybody with half a brain knows that this is clearly not a real estate dispute, and under international law, the Israeli judicial system has no legal authority over the population that it occupies. Well, why is it still continuing then?
Because of its failures. Israel gets more and more aggressive every time it fails. And it failed militarily in this recent campaign. But what motivated Sheikh Jarrah was its frustration over its failure over the deal of the century. It didn't win with the Palestinian people. In fact, you begin to see from the time of the collapse of the deal of the century, factions in the West Bank and in Gaza working more in unity. Now we can finally see the beginning stages of the collapse of the PLO and the PA as the comprador authorities since Oslo that have basically coordinated with Israel on arresting Palestinians and containing and holding the West Bank, essentially. So right now, in order to basically completely annex every single last piece of the West Bank, which was a project that has always been, carried out by Israel since 1948, every single village was Sheikh Jarrah at some point, but especially accelerated after 2018 as part of Netanyahu and the Zionist entities' push to aggressively take back all, completely colonize all of the West Bank. And this is also because of their failures in extending their fake borders. They never declared their borders to begin with because Greater Israel wanted to extend regionally. And the failure of their external campaigns over the years in Lebanon in 2006 and 2000 and in Syria most recently is causing them to channel that frustration inward. And everywhere you see the Zionist entity lashing out. It's lashing out and trying to, roll over hundreds and thousands of new settlements. Of course, it's always operated in impunity and still thinks it can get away with it. It's learning that it's very wrong in that regard. Right now, after the ceasefire, just 12 hours after the ceasefire was called, the Zionist occupying forces went back into Al-Aqsa and terrorized protesters. Right now, they're doing the same thing that they did in Sheikh Jarrah to Siwan, like another village in Palestine.
Exactly.
So it's a sign of their losing strategy, but it's also a continuation of the violent settler colonialism and ethnic cleansing that began in earlier even than 1948, but officially recognized by the international community. in 1948.
Brett Yonkers, I'm going to bring the same. Sorry to jump in there, Ms. Cussin. We're running short of time. One last question for Mr. Yonkers in Hasselt. I'm going to bring the same question to you. More land grab and evictions are being carried out by the Israeli regime. Palestinians in the town of Silwan, as Ms. Qasem just mentioned, in the occupied East Jerusalem al-Quds, are facing new illegal expulsion threats similar to those in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. Expelling an occupied people out of their homes in order to transfer the occupier's population into those homes is a war crime under international law. Why are these policies still continuing?
Yeah, I think I agree with Ms. Qasem about the core principle here. Indeed, there is a the Zionist entity is becoming more and more of a cornered animal. But when you corner an animal, of course, it tries to strike back as much as it can, and it can grow in ferocity. And I think that is something that we have been seeing for a while now, especially the last couple of years. And this has also, I believe, caused the Zionists to really become more unhinged, let's say, in the things that they are doing. They see now that, you know, the eastern part of Al-Quds cannot just be bullied out of the hands of Palestinian people. Of course, they have been moving settlers in and bullying them and threatening them and even committing all sorts of aggression against them for years now. But now, of course, they are threatening to use judicial methods in order to, let's say, quote-unquote, legalize the de facto and the de jure expulsion of these people, because they are losing patience. Indeed, they are losing patience with the slow speed in which these things are going and with the tenacity of the Palestinians in resisting this.
Sure.
And this unhinged reaction by the Zionists will also, I think, be translated into the reason why they specifically attack the Al-Aqsa Masjid. So so far they have been trying for decades to say that Israel offers religious freedom and offers the Arabs, the Palestinians, the chance to pray as Christians or Muslims, but now they are attacking the very sanctuaries of Islam itself as a consequence of their loss of patience and their unhinged response to it.
All right, thanks a lot. That's all the time we have for this program. Allow me to thank my guests, journalist and political analyst Julia Qasem, joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Thanks to historian and journalist Brett Yonkers, joining us from Hasselt, Belgium. And also special thanks to you for staying with us on Debate. Bye, everybody.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Suratul Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses, and then we'll be back. So stay with us.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
وَلَقَدْ أَرْسَلْنَا نُوحًا إِلَى قَوْمِهِ فَقَالَ يَا قَوْمِ اعْبُدُوا اللَّهَ مَا لَكُمْ مِنْ إِلَٰهٍ غَيْرُهُ أَفَلَا تَتَّقُونَ.
And we had certainly sent Noah to his people, and he said, O my people, worship Allah, you have no deity other than him. Then will you not fear him?
Brothers and sisters, we are now into another section or part of this chapter, chapter Mu'minun. And you may remember that we mentioned different sections and parts, content-wise, for this chapter. This section that we are going to talk about is starting to talk about saving Noah and his followers that is mentioned in the Holy Quran. In the 23rd verse, this surah states, وَلَقَدْ أَرْسَلْنَا نُوحًا إِلَىٰ قَوْمِهِ فَقَالَ يَا قَوْمِ اُعْبُدُوا اللَّهِ مَا لَكُمْ مِنْ إِلَٰهٍ غَيْرُهُ أَفَلَا تَتَّقُونَ. And we indeed sent Noah unto his folk, and he said, O my people, worship Allah, you have no other God save him, will you not keep from evil? In the previous section, and in the previous verses, Allah spoke of the creation of man and what supplies his material needs. Now in these verses, he attends to the supply of man's intellectual and doctrinal food. In other words, dear listeners, the previous noble verses mentioned monotheism, knowledge of Allah, and the reasons of His majesty in the world of creation. And this matter has been told from the mouths of the great prophets and by using the events that have unfolded throughout the history. For example, we talked about manafi'u kathira, that the Almighty Allah had put in the cattle. Anyway, this section starts with this verse. وَلَقَدْ أَرْسَلْنَا نُوحًا إِلَىٰ قَوْمِ. And indeed, we sent Noah unto his folk. فَقَالَ يَا قَوْمِ اعْبُدُوا اللَّهِ. And he said, O my people, worship Allah. مَا لَكُمْ مِنْ إِلَهٍ غَيْرُهُ. You have no other God save him. أَفَلَا تَتَّقُونَ. Will you not keep from evil? So at first, this part of the chapter begins with Noah and the bearer of the news of monotheism.
على مر الزمان تألقا وأضاء للدنيا طريقا.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
we
approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran. by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
The verse says, وَلَقَدْ أَرْسَلْنَا نُوحًا إِلَىٰ قَوْمِهِ فَقَالَ يَا قَوْمِ. He said, Oh my people. One interesting point in this case is when you are talking about the religion, when you are inviting people to be as close as they can to the religion of Allah, you have to talk to people in the kindest way possible. He said, Oh my people. So the people are addressed in this kind way so that they may be attracted to this religion of the Almighty Allah. The second point. At first he said, Ya qawmi abudullah. The first thing he invited the people to was monotheism. And this is the very first obligation, this is the very first mission of all the prophets. So, in missionaries, the main things have to be focused and they have to be emphasized. U'budullah, worship Allah, this is the very first thing. There might be some smaller issues to talk about, but we have to start from the very base, from the very beginning. Another noteworthy point regarding this verse, dear listeners, is that it seems that all human beings innately, naturally, have the inclination towards the Almighty Allah. So it seems that this spirit of worshipping is existing, has existed actually throughout the history in the depth of the hearts of the human beings. What the prophets do in this case is that they just try to introduce the case. So they say, "U'budu Allah, ma lakum min ilahin ghayru." That is where you have to turn your worships to. That is where you have to keep turning to. And this is actually what the prophets do. What they do is not in contrast with the very innateness nature of human beings. And at the end the verse says, أَفَلَا تَتَّقُونَ. Will you not keep from evil? Can be understood that to serve other than Almighty Allah is impiety and recklessness. So that's it with the first verse of this section, the 23rd verse of the chapter. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Why ends when faith begins?
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Round the world with reporters.
At a summit in Brussels, EU leaders have taken the highly controversial decision to advance plans on the vaccination of children against COVID-19. The European Commission says more than 300 million doses of COVID-19 vaccine will have been delivered to EU member states by the end of this week.
If we continue like this, we have confidence that we will be able to safely reopen our societies. So we must now focus on consolidating this progress. One important element that we've been discussing is the vaccination of minors.
EU leaders have chosen to completely ignore a plea from the World Health Organization. The WHO clearly states that vaccinating children and other low-risk groups in the EU happens at the expense of health workers and high-risk groups in poorer countries.
The People's Vaccine Alliance is a coalition of more than 50 organisations. In an extensive survey of epidemiologists commissioned by the Alliance, two-thirds warned mutations could render current COVID vaccines ineffective within a year. Hence the need, they stress, to vaccinate the world, not just rich countries.
EU leaders are under enormous pressure to somehow save the bloc's floundering economy, and they see the vaccination of their own people as the key. Millions have lost their jobs in the EU. Young adults have been worst affected. Experts we have been speaking to say the EU has given young people limited skills, particularly when it comes to the digital economy.
We need to change and constantly update our educational systems. And not only educational, we need to speak about the learning as such, which is much wider concept than what is being taught in schools.
The EU is facing unparalleled economic and social crises. Critics say the vaccine rollout was happening much too slowly. Now, as it speeds up, it's perpetrating, quote, scandalous inequality in the context of poorer countries, according to the WHO. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
On April 6, 1994, an airplane carrying then Rwandan president Juvenal Habyarimana was shot down as it prepared to land in Kigali, killing everyone on board. Military commanders of Rwanda's Hutu-dominated republic announced the president's death, blaming the Rwandan Patriotic Front, RPF, an organization dominated by the rival Tutsi minority, for the attack. Within a few hours, the commanders ordered people of Hutu identity to spare no Tutsi in the country, including infants. The mass killings went on for around 100 days, leaving at least 800,000 people dead. During Habyarimana's years in power, France maintained close relations with him as part of its France-Afrique policy. The French assisted Rwanda militarily against the RPF during the country's civil war in the years before the massacre. In the first few days of the genocide, Paris launched a military operation to evacuate French expatriates from Rwanda, refusing to allow any Tutsis to accompany them. According to the Human Rights Watch, the French military presence after the killings also effectively helped the perpetrators of the genocide to escape to neighboring countries. The question of France's role and responsibility in the genocide has burned between the two nations for decades. However, ties have warmed under French President Emmanuel Macron. Macron made a symbolic visit to Rwanda after three decades of diplomatic tensions. His highly anticipated speech fell short of a formal apology, but he recognizes country's responsibility.
Ever since 27 years of bitter distance passed, 27 years of incomprehension, of a sincere attempt to get closer that was unsuccessful, 27 years of suffering for those whose intimate stories remain mishandled because of the antagonism of the memory, and so with modesty and respect by your side today, I come to recognize our responsibility.
Even though the French president tried to reconcile with Rwandan people, genocide survivors were disappointed at Macron's failure to offer a clear apology.
We remember the French who went to the checkpoints, who worked with the ex-government, and who helped them to distinguish between the Tutsis and the Hutus. I mean, it is very... we cannot forget that easily. We need to be honest. They have participated. They helped. It was time to say sorry, without going around it.
The official report of the latest inquiry in France's role in the genocide commissioned by Macron in 2019 said that Paris was responsible but not an accomplice. The report, along with the lack of an apology from Macron, shows that France still does not want to admit its complicity in the 1994 genocide.
Elections ended on Thursday after millions of Syrians cast their ballots on the 26th of May to choose one of the three presidential candidates as the nation's next leader. Speaker of Syria's People's Assembly, Hamoud Esabagh, announced the final result in a press conference.
I am delighted and honored to announce the victory of Bashar Hafez al-Assad as the President of the Syrian Arab Republic. I express in the name of the Syrian People's Assembly our pride and appreciation and congratulations to our great Syrian people who voted for a free and great leader.
More than 13 million Syrians out of 14 million voted in favor of Assad. People filled the streets and main squares of major cities, celebrating what they say is a victory against all states that opposed the elections. Chanting slogans in support of President Bashar al-Assad, Syrians danced, sang, and expressed in all ways possible their feelings for their leader.
Western enemy countries' economic sanctions caused food and basic supply shortages in Syria, which forced Syrians to line up for hours at shop doors. Those countries today are definitely surprised to see those lines of people on the streets now expressing their love to President Assad and Syria. We'll continue supporting Assad even if bread, water, food and gas are not available.
We are gathering today in all squares to tell all countries of the world that no country will defeat us. No matter how much plots they hatch, we are with Assad and we are steadfast. We all love President Assad.
Currently, Syrians' main demand is for President Assad to improve the economic situation in the country, which is suffering under harsh economic sanctions imposed unilaterally by the West and the United States.
It's a historic moment in Syria, and Syrians have made that clear on the streets. They are celebrating victory over all states that wanted to forcibly topple the country's president for years, that they are the owners of this land and have the right to determine their country's future. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
The president of the UN General Assembly visited Pakistan. Volkan Buzgar met senior Pakistani authorities, including Foreign Minister Shah Mahmood Qureshi. His agenda includes regional and international issues, including Palestine, Kashmir, and the Afghan peace process. At a news conference, the president of the UN General Assembly made it clear no one can remain impartial in the face of Israeli atrocities against the Palestinians. Volkan said that political will shown by the General Assembly on Palestine must be used to force the UN Security Council for the resolution of this long-standing problem. During the 11-day Israeli aggression against the Palestinians, the United States blocked several attempts by other members in the UN Security Council to pass a resolution against Israel. Pakistani Foreign Minister Shah Mahmood Qureshi briefed the UN General Assembly President about the current situation in the disputed Kashmir region. Kashmir remains a disputed territory between India and Pakistan since 1947. Both countries fought wars and held dialogue, but have so far failed to break the stalemate. Among other issues that came up for discussion during the visit of the UN General Assembly President include the current situation in Afghanistan. Both sides agreed there is no military solution to the Afghan war and that all sides must seize the current opportunity for a peace deal. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
To some, it's the most anti-Israel country in Europe. To others, the most pro-Palestine. Ireland, a nation of nearly 5 million and a member of the European Union. Days after a ceasefire ended 11 days of fighting set off by Israeli provocations in occupied Jerusalem al-Quds, Ireland has become the first EU member state to condemn Israeli settlement activity.
The Dáil has unanimously supported the Sinn Féin motion, which recognises that Israel has illegally de facto annexed large portions of Palestinian land, which is totally illegal in international law. So this is a momentous decision.
The Parliament made other decisions too. It stopped short of adopting an amendment from small left-wing party People Before Profit that called for the Israeli ambassador to Ireland to be expelled.
Although it's disappointing that we have seen that we haven't got the expulsion of the Israeli ambassador, we still have to focus on moving forward with other matters. But in saying that, there's absolutely no support for the Israeli ambassador being in Ireland within the general public. I mean, that's evident across all social media platforms.
The latest move is one of several in Ireland to support the Palestinian cause. The most recent examples, the 2017 hoisting of the Palestinian flag over Dublin City Council to mark 50 years of Israeli occupation, the funding of multiple developmental and humanitarian projects in Gaza, and the 2018 introduction of the Occupied Territories Bill. Still to become law, the bill hands down hefty fines or jail sentences to anyone found guilty of importing or selling goods originating from the Golan Heights, East Jerusalem Al-Quds, or the illegal settlements in the West Bank. Slammed by Israel as an expression of full hostility, the bill and the latest condemnation are considered massive wins for the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. What has helped foster Irish solidarity with the Palestinian cause? The country's own experience with British colonialism.
The Irish people's bloody struggle for independence from British rule has inspired an emotional connection with the Palestinian struggle, a connection that continues to inspire them to support the Palestinian cause and call for an end to the conflict through Palestinian self-determination. Said Huriza, London.
Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah gave a televised speech to commemorate the 21st anniversary of the liberation of South Lebanon from the Israeli occupation. May 25, 2000 represents, as Said Nasrallah noted, the beginning of an era of victories for the resistance in the region. The most significant stance in this year's speech was a warning to the Israelis to keep their hands off Al-Quds and Muslim and Christian holy sites in Palestine.
The resistance in Gaza created a balance where they said any assault on Al-Aqsa Mosque and Al-Quds will lead to a military confrontation. The new equation that we need to reach is that if they touch Al-Quds, then there will be a regional war. This means all the resistance movements in the region cannot stand idly by if the holy city and the sanctities are under genuine threat. This is a genuine promise that the people of the resistance in the entire region will not forsake the holy city or the Muslim and Christian holy sites to be destroyed.
The leader of the resistance in Lebanon gave a detailed explanation of why the latest confrontation was exceptional and why its results yielded a victory for the Palestinians and a defeat for the Israelis. Experts believe the many victories for the resistance in Palestine are part of the era of triumph, which began in May of 2000.
All the past wars and victories from 2000 to 2006 in Lebanon to 2008 in Gaza until the last battle were all evidence of the accumulation of achievements for victory of the resistance. Today in Gaza in 2021, we saw the peak of the accumulated victories and the failure which is lived by the Israelis. The resistance was able to unite all the Palestinian people, and that victory was an extension of the victories in Lebanon. Now the Palestinian resistance is at the heart of the resistance front in the region, enforcing new realities.
The Lebanese celebrate May 25th as a national holiday, though the last Israeli soldier left South Lebanon on May 25th, 2000, signaling an end to over 18 years of invasions and occupation of Lebanon. The Lebanese official stance considers the Shabah Farms and Kfar Shuba Hills as Lebanese territory that should be liberated.
Celebration of Liberation Day this year in Lebanon has become intertwined with the victory in Palestine, while Lebanese recall that years of sacrifice and resistance against Israeli occupation led to liberty. They believe it is their duty to motivate the Palestinians to continue on that same path until they reach complete freedom. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The remaining signatories of the nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, enter into a fifth round of talks aimed at reviving the agreement through the removal of U.S. sanctions and a return to full compliance by Iran.
The experts will continue the discussions in the working groups. In the meantime, the European Union, as coordinator, will continue the talks with all participants of the JCPOA and separately with the United States in view of finding common grounds for an agreement to take shape.
Iranian lead delegate Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi said the difficult issues that still need to be resolved have become less, although decisions must be made on the remaining differences.
We have made some progress on them, but we are not still in a position to say that we have a clear answer for them and a clear solution actually for these key issues. But I'm confident that we would be able to make progress this time and, if possible, conclude the negotiations, which I have to repeat, I'm not confident that it would be possible to conclude the negotiations, but there is the possibility.
Iran has been demanding the removal of all U.S. sanctions, including those imposed under other labels against individuals and entities under the former administration of Donald Trump. Iran has also made it clear it would only come back to full compliance after it has verified the effective removal of sanctions, demands that up until now have not been met. Araghchi says he's seen determination and seriousness by all parties involved to reach a conclusion in the coming days, a prospect that he admits is still not by any means certain. Homolesky, Vienna.
The UK Home Office is under the spotlight once more after Home Secretary Priti Patel oversaw an immigration raid under the guise of observing the implementation of the law, but which nonetheless outraged many.
There are other ways to uphold the rule of law and the practices and policies and rules and regulations of any government without sensationalising the misery of you know, people who are extremely marginalised, excluded, and many of which have, you know, travelled an awful long way to seek the safety and international protection of the United Kingdom.
In Scotland, despite hundreds turning out to prevent a similar immigration bust, Priti Patel reiterated that she believed British people supported and voted for such scenes.
The Home Secretary is completely delusional. I don't think there was ever a vote that said, do you agree to people being rounded up like cattle, denied their right to appeal, denied an opportunity for their family members to be informed that they have been rounded up, and to be deported or administratively removed from the United Kingdom.
The Windrush scandal also continues as part of the hostile environment to affect many people.
There are one and two and three generations of people being denied services, people being denied access to university places, people not being able to access medical treatments, denied opportunities to access social housing, and it is an absolute blight on this government.
Many people think that modern Britain is simply a far cry from the welcoming image which is often presented to the world.
The hostile environment created by the UK government continues to have a devastating impact on communities, with legal experts concerned about many cases of unlawful detainment and deportation. Richard Sudan, London.
As anti-racism activists, Black Lives Matter demonstrators, and U.S. officials marked the killing of George Floyd with memorial events and marches around the country, the members of the victim's family met with President Joe Biden. In New York, civil rights activist Reverend Al Sharpton and several other officials, including the city's mayor Bill de Blasio, gathered and kneeled in a symbolic move to remember the black man's murder.
As we want to dramatize to the world the insensitivity and outright total lack of any concern that this officer had, he put his knee on the neck of George Floyd for 9 minutes and 29 seconds. And you've got to have a lot of disregard for the law, disregard for human being, to have something throbbing under you that long.
During the memorial, de Blasio slammed the persistent U.S. police brutality and racism.
How do you forget someone's humanity? Well, because for 400 years in this country, the persistent, obsessive training was to tell white people not to value black lives. It was everywhere you turned, and it poisoned the marrow to that officer. What he did disgusts me to this hour of this day.
More than 150 years after the 13th Amendment abolished slavery in the U.S., opinion polls show most American adults believe the legacy of slavery continues to have an impact on the position of black people in society. Following the murder of Floyd, Americans and people around the world ramped up calls to root out law enforcement misconduct and violence against black people. After a year, the divided U.S. Congress still struggles to find a compromise to pass a federal bill in response to the ongoing controversial methods of policing. The 46-year-old Floyd was killed in Minneapolis by white former officer Derek Chauvin, who was convicted last month of murder. While the conviction of Chauvin, who faces up to 40 years in prison, marked a new chapter in the U.S., incidents of similar nature have nevertheless persisted in the country ever since. A year after the brutal murder, activists say measures taken by some jurisdictions, which have been on the books for years, are insufficient to address the issue of systematic racism in the U.S. criminal justice system.
Yemeni people and government officials headed to Hamas office in Yemen's capital Sana'a to extend their congratulations to Palestinians for their historic victory over the Israeli regime and to express solidarity with Palestinians against any new Israeli aggression.
We in the Hamas movement live here among our Yemeni brothers who share with us the joy of victory, and this is something expected from the Yemeni people. This victory was achieved thanks to God and thanks to the efforts of the brothers in the resistance axis, including Yemenis. We share the same goal and vision with the Yemeni people who made the issue of Palestine one of their top priorities despite being involved in a deadly war by Saudi Arabia and its allies.
The Yemenis called on the Palestinian resistance to continue its armed struggle against Israel. They also thanked Iran for its open support for Palestinians' resistance groups.
We came here to congratulate our Palestinian brothers on this great victory that delighted the Yemenis and all the free people of the world. This victory was clinched with the blessing of God and the great support of Iran, and it was a confirmation of our unified stance against our common enemy Israel, who was defeated in this battle. The resistance groups must continue their armed struggle until the liberation of all occupied lands.
Israel killed hundreds of civilians, including women and children, in its war on Gaza and its deadly crackdown on Palestinians on the occupied West Bank earlier this month. Palestinian resistance groups responded by hitting the Israeli occupied territories with hundreds of rockets, which forced the regime to declare a unilateral ceasefire.
Yemenis say the ongoing Saudi war on their country told them that armed struggle is the only way to stand against aggressors. They believe that Palestinians are on the right path to regaining their territories from the Israeli occupation. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
This is Foresight. A program on how to worship Allah. Today's great tip: what are the specific secrets and manifestations of the Friday congregational prayer which enhance and strengthen our ubudiyah, our servitude of Allah? So, dear listeners, we're talking about the secrets and the specific secrets and the various manifestations and the outcomes of the Friday congregational prayers, the Salatul Jum'ah, which can increase and enhance our ubudiyah. Now, any and all kinds of worship and obedience to the Almighty, the All-Knowing, the All-Aware, Allah, subhanahu wa ta'ala, can enhance our ubudiyah, and it can strengthen our ubudiyah, our servitude of Allah. Now certain prayers, certain supplications, certain actions, and even refraining from certain things are all forms of servitude of Allah. They are all forms of ubudiyah, which a human being can do. And interestingly, every single one of these has its own